következő műsorszám 12 éven aluliak számára nem ajánlott. In other words, if you are 12 years old or younger, you should be in school and not listening to this radio show.
You're not dumb enough to actually try it. Know your rights. These are your rights. Oh, know your rights. These are your
Welcome to the May 23rd, 2011 edition of Mindenki Yoga. This is JD.
All programs.
This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite. Orbiting your living room, cashing in the Bill of Rights. Cuban army surplus or refusing of the lights. This is Radio Clash on Pirate Satellite. Yeah!
Today on Mindenki Yoga, we're going to talk about a Tahrir Square in Madrid, but in Budapest. And we're going to talk about True Finns in Finland. And we're going to talk about Anti-Homophobia Day here in Budapest and why the police shut it down, something called the three-day rule. More details on that later on. And then we'll do some Democracy Now! At the end of the broadcast.
Given deadly exhibitions of murder by Nepal.
Last May 17th was International Day Against Homophobia, against the fear or hatred of homosexuals, gays, lesbians, transsexuals, intersexuals, etc. But it's called the International Day Against Homophobia. So there was a small crowd that gathered at the Burger King at Octagon Square in Budapest on the Kor Rút. Was led by a man named Milan Roja, who's one of the organizers of this year's Budapest Pride March, which will be from June 11th to June 19th this year. The Budapest Pride is always controversial because it's often under violent attack by the extreme right, the police will often, in recent years, the police have had to shut down downtown Budapest in order to allow the assembly rights of the people who want to be on the Pride Parade. And the Pride Parade, let's put it this way. In most European cities, Western European cities, it's a Pride Parade, which is it's a celebration. But here in Budapest, it's called a Pride March because it's a civil rights march, more or less, because people are not only defending their right to be gay, but also people are defending the right to peaceably assemble, which is something that's guaranteed in the Constitution under many documents in the world, the right to assembly, the right to peaceably assemble. But unfortunately, in recent years, since 2007, Budapest Prides have become under violent attack, people throwing things, etc. We're going to talk more about the Budapest Pride and the march in the coming weeks. But this May 17th was International Day Against Homophobia. And so a man named Milan Roja and others organized a small march from the Burger King at Octagon They plan to go all the way to the parliament by way of going down Almashi Ut, the boulevard, Almashi Boulevard, all the way past Dayak Square, and then march towards the parliament. They got as far as Dayak Square, and then they were stopped by the police. It has to do with the three-day rule. Apparently somebody didn't inform the police ahead of time that they were going to have this march. But let's interview Milan Roja and ask him what's going on. Why is there an International Day Against Homophobia?
So my name is Milan Roja. I am 23 years old. I am a very enthusiastic beginner activist. I have joined actually this business end of January, and now I am a organizer of the Budapest Pride, responsible for the march, and I'm a coordinator at the Eurogames, which will be held next year here in Budapest. And today it's 17th of May, International Day Against Homophobia, and my idea was that we should draw attention what the homophobia causes, and I think that homophobia kills people, kills possibilities to have a beautiful life, to have a complete life, and actually kills children's dream. So this was the idea. And now we will just march from here to the parliament, and there we will light candles, remember by of the victims of homophobia.
And so I see someone out there with a t-shirt that says Meleg, and
yeah, swear words, because I think that people doesn't know that they just what they use and how often it is and how strong it is, and this is what we are wearing on the whole year, and I just want to draw attention that please don't use these words, because it might offend people, and it should be avoided. And this idea is very kind of an aggressive, because I don't think that if we just blow bubbles, which was last year, it causes any effect, because people just do not care. And I think it's a bit more aggressive, a bit more visible than people we know. Just for 1 second, if they think what the homophobia is and it might cause somebody's death, then I think I have reached my aim, and that's all.
There was a national survey recently that showed how much homophobia there is in Hungary, right?
I mean, it was 67%. They hate more the gays than the gypsies in Hungary, and 67% was homophobic or something like that. But before, when we had this civil partnership registration stuff, then 60% of the population have supported this. So I just don't know which is true and which not. I mean, what I can say that if I speak with people, and I can convince them that I'm a normal person, but still, it needs to be communicated. We have to speak about this, because we actually cannot wait that it will change, but we have to do something, and we have to be more active than passive.
So what's the plans for Budapest Pride this year?
So the Budapest Pride will be held between 11th of June, still 19th of June, and 18th of June. Saturday will be the march from Hero Square, at beginning of Andrássy Avenue, then all along Andrássy Avenue, and then Bajcsy-Zsilinszky Street and Alcott Main Street, the end of this, because we cannot go to the symbolic Kossuth Square, because there is a photo exhibition there. And of course, it was a very, very
convenient.
Yeah, very tricky it was. So I think before there were fences, now we have a photo exhibition, but the same effect. So it didn't change.
But it's longer than last year, at least.
Yeah, of course. And I hope it will be longer and more people. And I have contacted many, many others from Germany, for example, from Vienna. So we expect around 2,000 people. And I will be satisfied if there will be happy people and not just gay people, because it's not just a gay march, because it's a march for equality, and it's for everybody, and it has a message for everybody that be free and be what you are, and it just doesn't include the gay guys, but it includes everybody.
That was Milan Roja. So we arrived at the Gudur Club area of Esherbet Ter, which is near Deak Ter, Deak Ferenc Ter, and that's where the police stopped us from going any further.
Actually, that they just got my ID, just to get my, you know, the information about me. So now I am in the system. And, you know, and, I don't know, the new revolutionist or something like that. And now a police car will follow us away from, because they are afraid that we will be hit or something like that. And they want to protect us. But the first, what they said, that it's an unannounced demonstration, so we cannot march, you know, on the streets.
What's the new news?
I called the lawyer of ACLU, and he said that the police is right. We should have registered the demonstration. So it has to be dissolved.
So
it's stupid.
They shut it down.
Hmm?
They shut it down for today.
They
no
shut
more.
It down.
Okay.
It's over, and thank you.
You can sit there and have a beer.
I just want to deal with my chai.
And as you can hear, there's, you know, the police stopped us. They were very polite. They basically said we didn't inform them at least 3 days before that we should that we were going to have this march. Now, in Hungary, this sounds repressive, but in Hungary, you can protest anything you want. You have full free speech rights, as you would in any kind of modern country, you would say, except for you have to tell the police 3 days ahead. So. Unless it's an emergency, but something that's an annual event, like International Day Against Homophobia, that's an annual event, so it's not an emergency. So you can't really make that argument. Regardless, they should have informed the cops. They didn't. So therefore, the police dispersed and shut down the protest, of which was like 30, 40 people anyways, but it was shut down. So people just hung out at Gudur Club and had some beers. But while we were waiting there at Deak Ter, waiting for the police to decide whether or not to allow us to continue, Dori, who's the activist coordinator for Amnesty International Hungary, mentioned something very interesting.
So in the United Nations Periodical Review, which happens for every country in the world...
Yeah, every 4 years, all 192 countries will be reviewed under the same standards in front of the Human Rights Council. And one of the recommendations were, by one of the UN treaty bodies or by the UN Human Rights Committee, that they should amend the 72 hours rule, that you need to announce all demonstrations 72 hours prior to the event. Because that's a kind of restriction on freedom of expression.
So the UN is asking Hungary to change this rule that we just
Hopefully,
witnessed.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's one
thing which they are asking for.
Well, if we have a protest to change the rule, then we should tell them 72 hours ahead of time, right?
Yeah. No, we shouldn't.
No, we shouldn't. Oh, okay.
No.
And it turns out Dori is right. I looked it up, and I went to the United Nations Human Rights Council website and found Hungary. And this month, the United Nations Human Rights Council Working Group on Universal Periodic Review did in a long list of suggestions for improving human rights and civil rights here in Hungary, did mention this three-day rule as being something that should be changed. It's probably not the highest priority of human rights things in the world, but nonetheless, this is what the United Nations says about Hungary. Here, I'm going to read this directly from the United Nations Human Rights Council Working Group on the Universal Periodic Review for Hungary. Section 2, freedom of association and peaceable assembly, and paragraph 81. With the new constitutional process, acts or laws regarding the most important human rights, including the Act on the Right of Assembly, are to be reviewed. There are certain questions which are to be addressed. The problem of assemblies not announced 3 days before, such as spontaneous assemblies, the refinement of regulations concerning the protection of the demonstrators and security issues of the demonstrations. Now, this is interesting because, you know, there is a kind of, legally speaking, there is a big question of public safety or one's right to express oneself. And so, as I mentioned earlier, pride parades, pride marches, etc., have come under violent attack in the past. So the police decided this issue has brought out violence on the streets before, so public safety trumps personal expression, unless they were told 3 days ahead, which then they would have given us an escort to the parliament, and everything would have been fine. So then we would have had our public safety and our free speech rights protected. But since we didn't tell the police ahead of time, therefore they shut us down and we were not allowed to go further than De Acter, never allowed to get to the Hungarian parliament. So that's our civics lesson for the day. But I do promise that in a future episode of Mindenki Yoga, we're going to review the entire document from the United Nations Human Rights Council and the Universal Periodic Review of Hungary. I think this is going to be very interesting. There's lots of things that are said there, some that are predictable, some that I think are interesting. But nonetheless, we're going to talk about what the United Nations suggests that Hungary do to improve its human rights and civil rights. Now let's listen to some music, and we'll come back and talk about the Spanish Tahrir Square in Budapest.
You all fade away. So I dig what we all say. I'm not trying to cause a big sensation. Talking about my generation. My generation. My generation. Because we can get around.
Okay, next we're going to talk about Spain in Budapest. So there is an election that's about to happen, and in Spain, and Spain, like Portugal and Greece and Ireland, have been hit by the economic crisis. This is a credit crisis, and it's a housing crisis. I don't want to get into the economics of it, but it's caused massive austerity plans, massive cutbacks in the budgets, etc. And in Spain, there are two main parties. There's the Spanish Socialist Party, and then there's the Conservative Party. And while they might be different on certain issues, like, well, homosexuality, perhaps, and abortion would be another one, and other social issues, economically, they're pretty much the same. They might be slightly different in some respects, but they're the same neoliberal conservative economics, and they still have to do whatever Brussels and the IMF wants them to do economically in terms of spending on their budget and what goes to unemployment benefits and all this kind of thing. And so now you have a new generation of 20-somethings in Spain that want to see change and don't understand why there's massive unemployment for youth in Spain, and why they have to be punished for situations that they have nothing to do with, and they have no choice. In the elections, there's two main parties, and it's really hard for third parties or other parties to get in because there's a high threshold. I think I read somewhere that you have to get like 10% of a vote in order to get in, but I'm not sure about that. But nonetheless, there's a high threshold. Like here in Hungary, you have to get at least 5%, and then you can be represented in the parliament. And I think it's a higher threshold in Spain. That's what I think I read somewhere. And either way, the two political parties, the two main political parties, pretty much are the same economically. So why bother to vote when the two choices are the same? And that seems to be the crux of the issue for these young people. So a group of about 50 Spanish living in Budapest met to create a solidarity protest for what's going on in Spain. Spain, there's hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in the streets. There's 300,000 people that are protesting in Madrid, as well as cities all over Spain. And it's had some small confrontations with the police, but it's been nonviolent. And so these Spanish living here created their own solidarity protest at the Good Earth Club in the shade on a lazy Saturday afternoon, last Saturday. And they had signs, they had t-shirts, they just sat around in the sun, and then they also had some meetings. But first, we're going to talk to Maxigas, who's a long-term activist here in Budapest. And he's going to tell us about like how he found out about what's going on in Spain and why it's interesting. The Hungarian media hasn't said too much about the situation in Spain. Here's Maxigas.
So I went home around 10, 11 yesterday, and I just checked my mails and looked on the internet, and I realized that there is 300,000 people in Madrid. There is several tens of thousand people in Barcelona. And in all around Spain, in something like 15-20 cities, there are occupations of squares, and basically they are trying to make a franchise out of Tahrir Square and spread it north to Europe. And I thought it's such a beautiful idea, because when the politicians of Europe read this news, they would think it's a total nightmare. This is the worst that they could think. They didn't even think about this because they thought it's impossible, just the same as what happened in North Africa. I tried to make contact with other people who are on the ground and trying to find out what is happening. And so there is a website with a map, and now there is more than 500 locations on it. And it seems that all around the world, in Latin America, in North America, in Europe, even in Tokyo, there are camps that try to have solidarity with what is going on in Spain, but also try to push very similar processes in their local context. I got together with some people in Spain, and we started to put together a website. It's called takethesquare.net, and we are building it now as a kind of international coordination platform or communication platform for all these different diverse camps. So, because I'm leaving the country soon, I wanted to. I'm going to Sarajevo on Sunday. So I wanted to ask you if you can provide some pictures, interviews, and so on that we can publish.
Of course, and it will be published on lmv.hu Mindenki Yoga. Yes, of course.
Great.
So back to the Hungarian media. So you didn't see anything about what's going on in Spain in the Hungarian media?
Exactly. I was not surprised that the Spanish activists were complaining that there is 300,000 people in Madrid, and the television is showing the latest film of Almodovar instead of reporting what's going on in the city. And of course, it is even bigger news, not just because there are so many people, and not just because they don't really have very clear demands that could be met, and not just because there are no leaders that could be negotiated with, which I think is all very great, but also because there is an election day, I don't know, either today or tomorrow. All these people are calling for boycotting the election and introducing some kind of more participatory, more democratic system, because they don't believe anymore that this can be called democracy. And they don't believe in the parties, they don't believe in the unions. So, there is all this big thing going on, boycotting the elections. The High Court in Spain ruled that the gathering is illegal and it has to be cleaned up. But the Union of the Police of Spanish Policemen put out a press release saying that they are in solidarity with the demonstrations and they will not break it up. So it's an all big scandal, very interesting, very powerful, very significant in terms of news, even in the traditional liberal understanding of news. And then Al Jazeera had a little article about it. BBC, Telegraph, the English-speaking world somehow is really reporting it. I don't know about French and German newspapers, but there are camps in Paris and different cities in Germany as well. But if you look at the Hungarian media, it's total blackout. There is absolutely no mention of it, not even a small press release from the news agency. And this is very curious, because I know that all the media outlets have contact with international news agencies, of course. So I am sure that they have been already notified. It's true that the day before yesterday, as far as I know, there was something like 3,000 people in Madrid. It became very big yesterday, when there is this number of 300,000. Still, it's been going on since 24 hours. Once it was already breaking up by police, so there is this kind of spectacular violence that journalists should like usually like. We don't like that they like it, but usually they like it. Yeah. You know? And still, there is absolutely nothing in the Hungarian media.
That was Maxi Gass. Now, at one point, all these 40 or 50 Spanish, they're all sitting around in the shade at Good Air Club, under the trees, in Ejabetter. They were, at some point, they seemed to like instinctively get up and decide to have a political meeting. And they got in a circle and started to democratically assemble and discuss politics and why they're protesting and what to do next for their informal but loose organization, this Tahrir Egypt-style movement that's popped up all over, for Spanish people all over the world, even in Budapest. So here's a kind of a translated moment of the political discussion that was happening in the shade at Ejerbeter Park at the Gooder Club.
A ver, básicamente el franquismo se caracterizaba por tener un partido político vertical que te imponía a sus candidatos y tú votabas a un partido. Y claro, la gente dice, eso no es democracia, no puedes elegir. Ahora tenemos lo mismo, pero con dos partidos que nos crean la ilusión democrática. Pero es solo una ilusión.
He's saying that right now,
I also had a small discussion with some of the men that were involved and who are leading this Budapest Tahrir solidarity effort for what's going on in Madrid and all the major cities of Spain. Here's some of what they had to say about, like, why are they protesting?
This is to join the Spanish people who is in now in the Spanish squares. Because the situation in Spain, I know nobody knows really, because the newspapers and the TV, the information is not really exactly, I don't know.
Misinformation.
Yes. It's not really good. But the question is now in maybe we want a change in Spain. We don't want this kind of democracy, because we just have two big parties to vote, and they say we are different parties, but this bullshit, they're the same parties. And when now there is elections in Spain, and the question is, people is asking, what can I vote? What kind of party can I vote? Because I don't feel like nothing.
Just think about the option of the vote, because in Spain there are only two bigs, but there are a lot of more parties to vote. And with the election system that is now, the small parties can't never be elected, you know. So what people is saying is to think the your option. And don't like, if they can't win, we vote to this big to change, you know. Or just think about it. You can vote, no vote, or but a reflection about the.
No matter who you vote for, the system always gets in. Yeah. So how was this organized? How did these people know about this today?
Just because, well, we know most of us, we know each other from here. And speaking about the situation that is happening in Spain, and what can we do here to improve the movement? Mm-hmm. And with Facebook and, I don't know, from mouth to mouth.
Hello. So tell me, this is for a radio show here in Hungary on human rights issues.
What kind of radio? Alternative radio?
Well, my show is on human rights issues. Great. And it's English language.
Oh, no!
Yes, and I put Democracy Now on it, so everybody loves it.
It's great, Amy Goodman is great, it's great. I love this radio.
She's the best.
She's
the
working best. So hard against this all establishment, all the...
She's great. Incredible. It's great.
We are in the same move of her, you know? We want to do the same, just show to her people that we are disappointed, more than disappointed. It's not just about Hungary or about... it's about the... in Spain... last year, maybe from 2000, we were having a good life, you know, a lot of money, cheap credit, you know, the bubble of the construction was on the top, and all people had a job, a lot of money, good life. But when the crisis started, the created crisis for takeoff or rights, and the situation fall down, the social situation, and all socialist government started to make new laws about the, for example, labor law or some cheats, stealing or rights, and also okay, the main point is that in Spain there are like a partito crisis, two big political groups, socialists and conservatives, but they are the same shit, you know, just they have a little difference, like about the homosexual weddings or about the abort, but the main politics about economics or about social rights are the same shit, you know. They are the bitches of the banks, of the main economic powers, so of they are creating a neoliberal policies in Spain, so people are just tired.
So right wing and supposedly left wing, same neoliberal politics.
Yeah,
economics.
Yeah, but left wing in Spain is where, because in what side they are like a communist or something, but they are not really popular, and the socialists are worse than the conservative, because people in Spain know that they have to fight against conservative, but they still believe that the socialists are good, some of them. But right now the movement is a real democracy now. We want to create something different, to change the system. It's not just say, oh, you have to stop this law, or you have to do this or this. No, no, no. Okay, the point is, we don't want to work with you anymore, guys. We don't go to vote, because vote is legitimate. And this system is over, Vega. It's no more, you know, we need other. We want to talk, to create an assembly way, and just create a new system, a real democracy, not this fucking shit, because the topic is bigger. It's against all the political system, you know, all the state structures. It's not just about the socialists. They are in the power now, but then the other party will be, and it's gonna be the same shit. It's just change the system, create a new system. Also anti-capitalist, you know, all this stuff. Amy Goodman is great.
Thank you. What's your name? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm Emilio.
Emilio? Nice to meet you. JD.
Ivan.
Ivan, nice to meet you.
So you can see the interesting thing that you know, you have a democracy, but you don't have any choices. People don't trust the choices that they're offered. We're going to return to this theme coming up after we listen to some music. But instead of talking about Spain, we're going to talk about Finland and true Finns. But let's listen to some music first.
Thank you.
shot, sure shot. Go out to the parking lot and get in your car and drive real far and drive all night. And then you see a light and comes right down and lands on the ground. And out comes the man from Mars and you try to run, but he's got a gun and he shoots you dead and he eats your head. And then you're in the man from Mars. You go out at night eating cars. You eat Cadillacs, Lincolns too, Mercurys and Subaru. And you don't stop. You keep on eating cars. Then when there's no more cars, you go out at night and eat up bars where the people meet. Face to face, get cheek to cheek, one to one, man to man, there's toe to toe. Don't move too slow, cause the man from Mars is through with cars. He's eating bars, yeah, wall to wall, door to door, hall to hall. He's gonna eat them all. Rapture, be pure, take a tour through the sword. Don't strain the rain, pain the train, you'll be singing in the rain. Say, don't stop.
More about Spain and the Arab Spring in Madrid, as it's been called in the media. But right now we're going to talk about Finland. Finland had an election recently, and people kind of some Hungarians have made some comments about the Finnish election because the Finns apparently had kind of a political earthquake where 20% of the vote was given to a very small party that people didn't really hear about before from the far right called the True Finns, you know, truer than thou or true in the real Finns. So there's Emily Suraka, I think I pronounced his name correctly. He's around 20-something. He's Finnish, and he's come to Budapest for a month, actually, to volunteer at Civil Radio. So I sat down with him to talk about Finnish politics and about this True Finn Party and what does it mean, and about Finnish history and politics and similarities and commonalities between Finland and Hungary. I think most Hungarians think of Finland. They probably think of their phones, Nokia phones, but they also think of these ancient roots to Central Asia that Hungarians, Estonians, and Finns share a common heritage, if not genetic, but then, if not genetic, then some kind of linguistic roots, since all three have, I have to say, very strange languages and very difficult to learn. So I talked to Emily about this. But here's Emily Soraka.
Hello, my name is Emily Soraka, and I come from Finland, where I study media, radio and TV, that kind of stuff.
And you're here for a month or so and study and to learn about Hungary?
Yes, I'm here for 1 month and I'll be working in a radio station, local radio station called Civil Radio.
I think we've heard of Civil Radio. Maybe we're listening to it right now. So tell me about, I think, you know, Finland's not much in the news very often. I think most people's connection with Finland is their Nokia phones, maybe, but that they know about anyways. But there's been the True Finn Party in Hungary, or sorry, in Finland that has gotten about 20%, I think.
Yes, yeah. 20%.
And of course, Hungarians know of the connections to Finland since they believe that there's some kind of genetic, historical, cultural connections, but we could talk about that in a moment. But tell us about these True Finns. What does it mean, True Finn?
Well, basically, what True Finns are after is like the opinion of basic people or just the normal Finnish people, and they have been blamed of being a populistic party because they pretty much do what the normal people would like to do, and like easy and simple solutions to hard questions, which is kind of, yeah, I don't know if that's the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. You may never know about these politics, but yeah, the main thing that True Finns have become famous about in last couple of months is their attitude towards helping countries like Portugal in this economical crisis thing, which, yeah, basically True Finns don't want Finland to give money to these countries because they don't believe that it's gonna help, but we should instead find some other solutions to the problems. And I don't know, I'm not saying that I'm a True Finn, but they have some ideas that they base well on. They have their own opinion, and I'm not saying it's wrong, but they also have this really like, they also have these opinions that I don't agree at all, like with the policies about people moving to Finland from other countries of Europe and outside Europe. They don't want basically people, or they want to shut down Finland. So that's what I don't agree with.
So True Finns are reacting, you're saying that they're coming from a reaction to European events more than domestic events?
Yeah, at the moment, because economical crisis is a big thing at the moment in Europe. So yeah, at the moment they basically talk about the economical crisis. So that's the biggest thing, I think, being put up to the wall or something. I don't know how to explain.
But just so our listeners understand, so Finland has the euro, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so Finland's completely within the euro, and so Portugal and Greece and Ireland, these countries that are being bailed out, they also have the euro. And so there's a question of Finland, which has surplus money to give to support these other countries that have gotten themselves into an economic mess. The question is, why should Finland pay for this? And so, but this is the questioning or the resistance to this is coming from the right wing in Finland. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's interesting because, like in other countries in Western Europe, I think the resistance to this would be coming from the left wing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's interesting.
Yeah, there is. Actually, I think that in Finland, the True Finns, they are not, it's hard to say if they are left or they are right. They are not actually right. in whole. They have like ideas from all the from left and so. But I think at the moment the Portugal aid was like accepted, so Finland is gonna aid Portugal. And one group that voted against it was the like middle section. Finland has this middle party. What would it be in English like? Centrists. Yeah, centrists voted against the Portugal aid. Mm. Mm. But I'm not actually quite sure at the moment what did the other parties do. But yeah, I can't really say that like the biggest right-wing party has all the time been with the Portugal aid and they're trying to pull it through. But yes, some are against it, some are not, but basically the right wing is the force driving.
So, but a key part of the European ideal or idea is that there's like no borders within Europe in theory, which of course there's exceptions to this, but so is there a lot of immigration to Finland that are scaring people? I mean, I don't think of Finland as an immigration country.
No, actually Finland doesn't take a lot of immigrants. It has like if we compare it to Sweden has millions and millions. I think I don't want to say any like correct numbers because they are probably totally wrong, but yeah, Finland doesn't take a lot of people in. But yeah, Finland is I want to think that Finland is an open-minded country, or it has been so far. But it is also afraid to let in these foreign cultures because there is still a strong, like, Finland is still strongly living in the past, and there are still a lot of people thinking that, yeah, Finland is a kind of this, I don't know, it's like in all countries. Where there are people that think that we shouldn't take foreign cultures in because they are gonna ruin everything and blah blah blah, and I don't myself agree with that. I think Finland should be open to all cultures and making a successful country in the modern world requires the ability to accept everybody in. Everybody should be equal, all people and all cultures and all religions.
So, you know, every country has its own idea of itself, whatever its maybe true Finn self or true Hungarian self or something. I think, you know, part of a Hungarian national ideal or popular view of its past is that Hungarians come from Central Asia around the Ural Mountains in the middle of Russia today, and even though if you go there, the people there don't speak Hungarian. Maybe there's some kind of linguistic connections. And there's supposed to be linguistic connections, maybe other connections to Finland and I think Estonia. I'm curious, does your true Finn or just your average Finn feel that they have a connection to Central Asia?
No. I think an average Finn has some kind of an idea maybe that there are linguistic connections between, well, at least Estonia, because Estonia and Finland are very much alike as languages, but and probably an average Finn also knows that we have some linguistic connections to Hungary and Eastern Europe, but no, really like a true Finn doesn't believe that we come from Asia. True Finn wants to think that we are like our own people. We are Finns and we don't come from Asia. We are just Finns, I think.
Very interesting. And so, but I think there's another interesting kind of more recent rather than 2,000 years ago connections. A lot of the Hungarian view in terms of foreign policy is connected to fears, rightly in many respects, to Russia. Can you give me a little bit of
Finnish history in the last 100 years in brief.
Yeah, Finland became independent country in 1917, and it was because Russia was becoming a Soviet Union, and during that process Finland had its chance to claim its independence, so happily Finland took that chance. Before that, Finland had been, I think, Russia dominated Finland for 100 or 200 years, I can't remember quite correctly. And before that, Finland had been part of Sweden for hundreds of years. So, yeah, actually, Finnish identity started forming under the Russian government, and we had this system that in many things we could govern ourselves, and we had our own Finland had its own nationalistic art and music coming, and that's how Finland became Finland. And yeah, after Finland became independent, there was a civil war, as in many cases happens when a new country is born, what follows is civil war. So right wing actually won that war. It was red against white, as we say it in Finland. And the red ones were basically annihilated, and for next 20 years until the Second World War, Finland was very much a right-wing country. And yeah, I don't really know if that is a good or bad thing, but during Second World War, Finland was allied to Germany and the Central Countries, and what happened was that Finland pretty much lost with Central Countries, but what's important is that Soviet Union didn't conquer Finland. So Finland kept its independence, but it was still very much Finland had to bow to the East, you could say it that way, for the next 50 years until the 90s came and the fall of Soviet Union. But anyway, during that time in 50 years, Finland had a huge economical boost. Finland grew a very wealthy and healthy country. And yeah, even though we were the losing side, or Finland was the losing side in Second World War, we didn't have it as rough as maybe some other countries in Eastern Europe.
And so today Finland is in European Union, it uses the euro, it's a NATO country as well?
No. Finland isn't a NATO country.
No?
No.
I'm ignorant, sorry, I thought it was.
Yes, Finland, it's actually a huge discussion going on in Finland about if we should join the NATO or not, and the public opinion at the moment is that we shouldn't. And yeah, the right wing, I think at the moment they are very hard and they are very keen to get us into NATO. But yeah, public is against.
What would the true Finns say about NATO?
I think true Finns say no to NATO mostly. There are many, as I said earlier, there are many different opinions inside true Finns, because they are not very one-minded party. They are having their own inner conflicts at the moment, and basically their popularity within people is based upon the populistic ideals about not taking more people into Finland from other countries and not giving aid to Portugal, and basically upon the fact that the last governments have failed in making any successful things work. And so people are now voting against the old system and for the true Finns would mostly say no to NATO.
Talk about you said that like free speech is like very central to.
Yeah, in Finland, the right of free speech is kind of everything in the sense that we believe that governments, what the government does, should be open. And actually, in the last 1 and 2 years, there has been like huge scandals in Finland concerning like the fundings of our politicians, their election like funding on. Mm-hmm. People are thinking that many politicians, as it is, like many politicians in Finland are getting money from these companies or different companies are, and that raises the question, does it affect their decisions? And I think that's pretty good questions, and I think the answer might very well be yes. So yeah, that kind of things, the media brings a lot of that kind of things up to the surface, and that's how I basically think Finland is able to, and that's the key ingredient in keeping a country like free and clean of the
corruption,
yes. And actually I might bring up WikiLeaks at this point, because I think what WikiLeaks is trying to do in America is pretty much the same thing what's happening in Finland at the moment. I'm not saying that Finland is like open in all senses, like, or that Finland is like really some iconic, really idealistic country that where everything is working well and the government is working well. That's not what I'm trying to say, but that maybe it's more closer to that ideal than what perhaps US is today. And I really much like about what WikiLeaks is trying to do, like bringing up these facts that governments don't really want to be brought up.
Total transparency in government.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've done a lot on WikiLeaks for the show. When the cables came out, then we did several shows on that, and it's interesting because you know the WikiLeaks thing then became the Arab uprisings. You know,
yeah.
So it just this thread just keeps going. You know, and it's changing the world, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, in the good way, and I believe it's changing the world in a good way. And it's like, I think it was the Prime Minister of Canada that said that Julian Assange, somebody assassinate that bastard or something, and I was just laughing at that. How can a politician in like democratic country say something like that? That's so stupid. He's like bringing himself to the light and like showing his true nature in front of whole like world. What a stupid man.
That was Emily Soraka. Thank you for the interview, Emily. It was very interesting. And going back to the Spanish Tahrir Square. So the Spanish have these major parties that don't offer any choice, even though they're supposedly left and right. And in Finland, the major parties also lost credibility because of their own corruption, and which created credibility for this far right party. But also the Finns are saying, why should we bail out Portugal? Why should we bail out Spain? Because Finland is a more prosperous country than Spain is right now. So, which is actually a very good question, because this neoliberal politics that's being imposed by the IMF onto Spain, well, it's being imposed by the IMF, but rich countries like Finland have to pay the IMF have to give money to the IMF and through other institutions to bail out these countries that have screwed up on the economics. So it's a question of democracy, it's a question of economic democracy, and it's all over Europe, whether it's Spain or Finland. The question is the same, in my opinion, but the expression of it can come out from the left or come from the right, but the issues tends to be about neoliberal economics at the base of it. I think it's very interesting. We live in a very interesting time, and we're going to hear more about this type of stuff in the future, I think. Let's listen to some more music.
Cojoba, Taina, Siboney, Caribe, Guanajuato Bay, Manicato.
¿Qué más tú quieres de mí si todo yo te lo he dado? Con las armas coaccionaron, se colaron. De África se adueñaron y me trajeron aquí. Llanto, lamento, sufrimiento en todo momento. Siempre fue así, que violento. ¿Hasta cuándo permitir que me la cuenten? 500 años, basta. Permitir que no te cansa, no te cansa. Pandilla de loco, muñeco de cuerda. Cerebro de a poco, perro que te muerda. Plaza, amperaza, al payá. Nuestros ancestros construyeron las casas. Nuestra gente plantó la caña. Libertó propiedades con tus mentiras y patrañas. Piraña, fueron nuestros tanques esclavos en este país. ¿Por qué me miras con desdén encima? Te comen mi maíz. Ahora las cosas son distintas. No sudamos en el trapiche, no. No nos venden en la plaza, no. Pero no estamos ni en televisión. No quieren negras en casa. Tan bella mi raza, tan fuerte, tan saludable. Y cuando abro la boca pa' percutir verdades crudas, de eso no hable. A mí me quieren callar a mí. Porque, ah, ah.
Yo, por ejemplo, parezco una mona, pero soy persona y pienso deprisa. Me gusta la risa, es mi preferida, pero existen tantas otras cosas. Hay en la vida que te creías pequeña, que el mundo iba a estar organizado y sería como tu cuarto polvo, bien pintado. Ni las diosas, ni los dioses han podido equilibrar para mejorar. Entonces debemos pensar que tenemos la que nos merecemos. Explotación, discriminación, pobreza, violencia, sopadera. ¿Quién la merece? ¿Quién la dese? ¿Quién siembra? ¿Quién la cuece? ¿Quién? Tiemblo de alucinaciones super verdaderas. Ya no hay quien controle toda esta loquera.
Sí, sí, llego hasta ti, me introduzco en tu corazón, produzco sensación escalofriante, la cruda como picante.
Calentándote el guiro, arrancándote el suspiro. Saber que se mujerea y escuchar que se corea. Que no habrá dificultad, que hasta gente buena calle. Que no habrá quien se desmaye. Bruja, tuerca, laye, laye. Yo mujer, yo libertad por siempre. A nadie le hago daño, ni una vez al año. Yo mujer, yo libertad.
A mí que mi ñongo,
a mí que,
a mí que mi ñongo,
a mí que mi ñongo,
a mí que,
a mí que mi ñongo.
Cada quien sabe lo suyo, cada quien.
Pa' mi raza la oprimida, unidad y un puño arriba es. Mi raza la dolida, la siento aquí, no es mentira. Mis costumbres las cambiaron, mis dialectos aplastaron. Mi lengua la olvidé. Huele, topa negro mata blanco malo. Huele, topa negra. Angunga, benguela, bombo, bozón, huentotera. Mumbona, mombasa, cananga, yaunde, maputí.
Mondongo, congo, lumumba, chife, zambese, tanganica, huecue.
Bujumbura, Luanda, conacri, tumbuctú, lomé.
Kigona, Eritrea.
Tire d'agua, araré. Quincamaché,
quincamaché.
Amigui, miñongo.
Yeah.
Next, we're going to listen to Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, and she's going to interview a guy named Jeremy Scahill. I think I've played Jeremy Scahill interviews in the past. He's an investigative writer for The Nation magazine in the United States. He's a very smart guy, and he's been investigating these mercenary groups that are funded by the U.S. Pentagon. The most famous one is called Blackwater, the name has been changed to Z, which is spelled X-E, which is pronounced Z. But anyways, people still call it Blackwater. And Obama in his campaign suggested that he was going to limit the use of these mercenaries. He was going to get them out of Iraq and all this type of stuff. Well, it's another Obama promise or somewhat of a promise that didn't really ever happen. And furthermore, Blackwater has gotten itself into some legal trouble. And the guy that runs Blackwater, Eric Prince, has suddenly moved to an Arab country. And people were curious about that. And it turns out he's creating an Arab army, a mercenary army for Arab countries. But the soldiers are Colombians and South Africans. So it really brings up some very deep questions about international corporations, who's in control of international corporations, sovereignty issues, human rights issues, democracy issues, all sorts of things. But let's listen to it. I think this is a huge issue. It was a huge issue, 10 years ago when this started, and now it's out of control, in my opinion. So let's listen to Jeremy Scahill, interviewed by Democracy Now!
The United Arab Emirates has confirmed hiring a company headed by Eric Prince, the billionaire founder of Blackwater. According to the New York Times, the UAE secretly signed a $529 million contract with Prince's new company, Reflex Responses, or R2, to put together an 800-member battalion of mercenaries. Documents show the force is intended to conduct special operations missions inside and outside the country, defend oil pipelines and skyscrapers from attacks, and put down internal revolts. The troops could be deployed if foreign guest workers stage revolts in labor camps or if the UAE regime were challenged by pro-democracy protests like those sweeping the Arab world. One contract document describes, quote, crowd control operations, where the crowd is not armed with firearms but does pose a risk using improvised weapons, clubs and stones. The UAE is a close ally with the United States, and it appears the deal has received the Obama administration's support. One U.S. official told the Times, quote, the Gulf countries and the UAE in particular don't have a lot of military experience. It would make sense if they looked outside their borders for help. They might want to show that they are not to be messed with. News of the deal also comes just weeks after the UAE's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan visited President Barack Obama at the White House late last month. A White House statement said Obama and the Crown Prince would discuss, quote, the strong ties between the United States and UAE and our common strategic interests in the region. A number of U.S. citizens, including former Blackwater employees, have occupied senior positions in the operation. Legal experts have questioned whether those involved might be breaking federal laws prohibiting U.S. citizens from training foreign troops if they did not secure a license from the U.S. Department of State. The force is reportedly made up of Colombians, South Africans, and other foreign troops. Prince reportedly has a strict rule against hiring any Muslims because he's worried they could not be counted on to kill fellow Muslims. Prince himself now lives in the United Arab Emirates after moving there last year under a cloud of legal controversy here in the United States. The UAE deal is the first to emerge publicly since Prince sold Blackwater and suggested he would leave the private military business behind. For more, we're joined by independent journalist, Democracy Now! Correspondent, Nation writer Jeremy Scahill, author of the award-winning bestseller Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. Jeremy was the first journalist to report on Prince's move to the United Arab Emirates 2 months before it was publicly confirmed. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy.
Thank you. Talk
about the significance of this mercenary army that Prince is setting up for the UAE.
Well, when Eric Prince decided to move to the United Arab Emirates, he gave an interview to a former CIA employee in Vanity Fair in which he said that he was going to to be leaving the Soldier of Fortune business and said he wanted to go and teach high school. And he said, you know, I'll teach history. Even Indiana Jones was a teacher. Well, it's true that Indiana Jones was a teacher, but he also was an anti-mercenary. And in fact, in a famous scene in the movie Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, his arch nemesis, Belloc, who's working for the Nazis, accuses Indiana Jones of giving a bad name to mercenaries. So Eric Prince, rather than pursuing that path, has actually pursued the path of the mercenary. And when he moved to the United Arab Emirates, he said he did so because it was a free society and a country that respected the free market. Well, it didn't take long for him to get down to business with the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi and essentially hatched a plot to build up a mercenary army within the borders of the UAE, relying on labor from Colombia. Blackwater has a long history of working with Colombians. In fact, Blackwater paid Colombians $34 a day to operate in Iraq. And when the Colombians protested their payments, saying that they were getting less than the Bulgarians or the others that were working for Blackwater, the white soldiers, that Blackwater threatened them, according to the Colombians, and wouldn't give them their passports back and said, you know, we're just going to release you onto the streets of Baghdad. And eventually the Colombians left. And they went and they assassinated the recruiter that had hired them for Blackwater. So it's ironic that Prince is using the Colombians. Now their pay has been increased to something like $150 a day. And the purpose of this force, as stated in the corporate documents and in the New York Times, is to deal primarily with the internal situation in the United Arab Emirates. Anyone who's been to the UAE knows that the economy is entirely fueled by migrant workers, people from the Philippines or from Pakistan or Bangladesh. And they live in these camps, and their conditions are not good, to say the least. So one of the concerns seemed to be that unrest could spread in those camps, and they didn't want to use UAE forces to quell those rebellions, but instead send in Eric Prince's. The other thing, Amy, that I think is significant about this, and we reported on this on Democracy Now! A year ago, Eric Prince gave a speech in late 2009 in which he talked about the rising influence of Iran in the Middle East and talking about how the Iranians were fanning the flames of Shia revolt. The regime in Bahrain has used the justification to crack down on protesters that they're agents of Iran or that they're being influenced or supported by Iran. And Prince essentially came up with a plan in front of this audience, a military audience, for the United States to advocate quietly sending in, this is in late 2009, quietly sending in private forces run by Americans or other Westerners into countries in that region with the express purpose of confronting Iranian influence. We now know that part of the UAE's arrangement with Eric Prince was aimed precisely at that. So this seems like it's been something in the works for some time. I spoke to Representative Jan Schakowsky earlier this week, who, of course, is on the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence and has been the most ferocious congressional critic of Blackwater. And she's raising some very serious questions about whether Eric Prince obtained the necessary license to export these types of services to a foreign country. You have to have a license, what's called an ITAR license, from the State Department that says, hey, this former Navy SEAL who has had access to top secret information from the United States actually is authorized to conduct these services. Blackwater has been fined in the past millions and millions of dollars by the Justice Department for not obtaining those kinds of licenses. So it could be, if he didn't obtain these licenses, that he is actually breaking U.S. law in providing these services to the UAE.
And what about other U.S. Americans going over there?
I mean, the fact is that one of the major sources of income and one of the things that the UAE is becoming famous for is being a playground for the war game globally. Companies that service the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have set up shop there because of the tax situation, because of its proximity to these war zones. And so you have massive, massive presence of the U.S. war industry in both Dubai and Abu Dhabi. And so for Eric Prince to set up shop there is no surprise. I mean, I know when I went to Afghanistan late last year, when you're in the airport in Dubai, it's journalists, rich Emiratis, or it's people in transit to Bangladesh or other countries, or it's the war industry. You see the 18-inch biceps, the wraparound sunglasses. I mean, it really is sort of a gateway to war and a good place to position yourself if you want to make a killing.
And the other Americans working with Prince and UAE?
Right. Well, there's a former FBI agent who actually, C.T. Chambers, who actually ran Blackwater's quote-unquote training operation in Afghanistan for a shell company that Blackwater set up called Paravan. And it seems as though this company was set up explicitly to keep the name Blackwater out of the contract bidding process. They won that contract, and Blackwater still has these contracts to train Afghan national police and military forces. That company came under an intense investigation by the Senate Armed Services Committee, led by Senator Carl Levin, exploring whether or not Blackwater and the massive war company Raytheon effectively conspired to win contracts for Blackwater while explicitly shielding or shrouding Blackwater's involvement in secrecy. Two members of that Blackwater force in Afghanistan were recently convicted of manslaughter stemming from the shooting deaths of two Afghan civilians. So the man who ran that program that's under intense congressional scrutiny right now, and Senator Levin has asked the Justice Department to investigate, is another key player in this Prince operation. He's supposedly making upwards of $300,000. But the contract is worth $100 million a year, and it started in June, and it's supposed to go through May of 2015.
We're talking to journalist Jeremy Scahill, who wrote the book Blackwater. We're also joined by Democracy Now! Video stream by Samer Muscati. He is the Iraq and UAE researcher for Human Rights Watch, joining us from Toronto. Talk about the human rights situation in UAE, Samer.
The human rights situation has gotten worse over the past few weeks. Since April 8, UAE authorities have detained five peaceful activists, including Ahmed Mansour, a prominent rights figure in the UAE and a member of our advisory committee board. And also, they have dissolved the elected boards of two of the country's longstanding civil society organizations, the Jurist Association and the Teachers Association. All this follows calls by citizens for greater electoral rights and greater freedoms. They signed a petition in March, and the associations made a public action in April asking for greater political reforms. And this has been the response of the government. So unfortunately, the situation has deteriorated further over the past few weeks. And the UAE also has a long tradition of abusing workers, including the ones that, unfortunately, this mercenary force appears to be set up to deal with. There's about 750,000 construction workers and a similar number of domestic workers in the UAE, and they have quite serious complaints, including the fact that they have to pay recruitment fees, which are illegal under UAE law. But they spend thousands of dollars to come to the UAE, and they're in debt. They work for jobs that pay them very little and in horrible conditions. Even this week, we see temperatures have risen to about 113 degrees Fahrenheit across the UAE, and construction workers are out in the sun for pennies, basically, slaving away.
This issue of who lives in the UAE and who would be whose rebellions would be quelled, if you could talk more about that, Samer, and how much the United States is involved with the UAE, a close U.S. ally.
I mean, there is no chance for rebellion. Even small protests we saw in January, the same day that we released our report in the UAE about human rights conditions over the past year, the UAE government detained and deported 71 Bangladeshis who had striked because of wage issues. So any sign of discontent or dissent, the UAE authorities act quite quickly to make sure that these type of actions are ended. And even with the latest arrests, I mean, these guys are basically asking for just basic reforms. They're not asking for an overthrow of the government. And we see the government has come down very hard on them. So the chance of having a widespread movement that we've seen in other countries, I think, is not plausible in the UAE. At the same time, the fact that they've taken such draconian measures against these activists, I think, only fuels the idea that reform is needed and in the long term undermines the UAE authorities and how they've responded to this so-called threat. So we're hopeful that these activists will be released soon, but there's no indication that they will be. And they're being looked at for crimes of opposing the government and for insulting the ruling family.
And the press coverage of what's going on inside UAE?
You know, the press coverage, similar to other press coverage of UAE human rights violations, is minimal locally. Many of the papers are run by the state, and there's a lot of self-censorship that happens with journalists in the UAE who are afraid to cover or unable to cover these issues. It's fitting that this piece was broken by the New York Times, and what we've seen from the UAE local press has been very little coverage of this issue. And the coverage we've seen has focused on the statement that was issued by the government as opposed to a lot of the allegations that have come through the New York Times. But it's typical. The press in the UAE is not free, and they're unwilling to report on the serious issues, including this crackdown, and basically present the government's opinion and analysis as opposed to what's happening on the ground.
And unions, Samer?
Unions, in the UAE, there are no unions, and people who try to informally organize and strike are deported if they're foreigners. And nationals, if you want to form an association, you have to apply. The regulations are quite stringent, and if they do interfere in what is perceived as politics, what we've seen is the UAE government clamps down, dissolves the board, and basically takes over associations. So there is no notion of unions in the UAE.
And what can the international community do? I mean, you have a lot of U.S. institutions as well, not only the U.S. government working with the UAE. You have NYU, Guggenheim, a number of institutions that are building branches there and operate there.
Absolutely. And we've called on these institutions to take a stand. These institutions are partners of the UAE government. They're receiving millions of dollars from the UAE government, and they're building these branches there, which I think is a good idea. But at the same time, they have to make sure that, you know, they're not tarnishing their reputation.
Who are they?
New York University is one. We have the Guggenheim. Sorbonne University, who is one of the lecturers, Nasser bin Raith, was actually detained and continues to be detained by the UAE authorities. We've written letters to these institutions asking them to take a stand and not to be complicit in the crackdown. The response we got from Sorbonne University, unfortunately, was, you know, they tried to minimize bin Raith's relationship with the university, as opposed to promising they'd actually voice their concern and demand his freedom. And we haven't received a response back from the other institutions who are eager and happy to take money from the UAE, but unfortunately they haven't been vocal about this latest crackdown, even though the Guggenheim, for instance, has been vocal in China when an artist has been arrested. But closer to home in the UAE, they've been very quiet. And if these institutions don't speak up, I mean, they're in an excellent position, then who will? These are institutions that are partnering with the government.
Jeremy Scahill.
Right. And well, as Samer talked about the issue of the UAE military confirming this arrangement with Blackwater, the spin on it was quite interesting in the official statement, because while much of the attention that's been focused by the New York Times on this issue has revolved around the potential use to suppress an internal rebellion inside of the UAE, the statement from the military there actually praised the work of Prince's company and other Western companies that have been working with the military, because it's enabled them to engage in quote-unquote successful operations in other theaters of operation like Kosovo, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya. Now, this is interesting because there is a ripe opportunity for mercenary forces to engage in Libya, either on contract with some form of a rebel government or alliance there. And so if Prince's company is involved with an arrangement through the UAE that somehow involves Libya, that would be the subject of quite a bit of interest, I'm sure, on Capitol Hill and in capitals around the world, because I think it's just a matter of time before we start to see an incursion of special operations contractors going in to Libya, if they're not there already.
Finally, Jeremy Scahill, the timing of Eric Prince moving to the United Arab Emirates, what's happening here at home, and then if you could also comment on John Ashcroft and his new position.
Right. I mean, Eric Prince put the wheels in motion to go to the United Arab Emirates almost immediately after the five Blackwater executives under him were indicted on a 32-count indictment, felony indictment for weapons violations, allegations of bribery, of lying to agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. The United Arab Emirates does not have an extradition treaty with the United States. I think that Eric Prince knows where so many bodies are buried that he kind of is in pole position in terms of being indicted himself. He's been graymailing, what they call it, the U.S. government, by leaking details of operations he's been a part of as a way of saying, if you come after me, I'm going to go Ollie North on you and blow the whole thing open. And so I think he more, in terms of strategic viewpoint regarding the investigations and indictments of Blackwater officials, Prince is trying to make it very difficult to be questioned in these matters. And the UAE is a safe place for him to operate. And if you have the support of the royals there, which he clearly does, and he's supporting them, it's a, you know, it's a marriage of convenience and love, apparently, then he has very little to worry about from them, despite the fact that this crown prince can sit with President Obama one day and then be hatching mercenary plots with Eric Prince next day is a stunning commentary on how little things have changed from Bush to Obama on this issue of mercenaries.
And John Ashcroft, the former attorney general.
You know, John Ashcroft has been named, I mean, you can't make this stuff up, has been named the chief ethics officer for the new Blackwater. That's actually being run by Bobby Ray Inman, who, you know, was a major figure under the Clinton administration, was picked to take over as defense secretary for Les Aspin, and his nomination was broiled in controversy,
advisor.
And he was the former national security advisor. So they're sort of trying to rebrand Blackwater. But, I mean,
New name, XE.
Well, you know, it changes every day. It's Z or it's United States Training Center.
USTC.
I mean, Blackwater has all these shadow entities around the world. I mean, we've seen a new one pops up every day. Now it's Reflex Response, now R2, Paravant, Greystone. I mean, I could list probably, I could sit here for 10 minutes listing their various shell companies for you. But, I mean, putting John Ashcroft in charge of ethics at Blackwater is like asking, you know, the fox to take care of the baby chicks, you know, on a farm somewhere and hoping everything's going to be fine. I mean, he's going to devour the very idea of ethics. If you look at his track record when he was attorney general, I mean, this is not an ethical man and not anyone that has any business overseeing the ethics of a notorious mercenary firm.
Finally, Nisar Square, the latest on it, the killings by Blackwater forces in Iraq.
Right. I mean, five Blackwater guards, as they're called, were indicted by the federal government for the shooting at Nisar Square, and the case was dismissed largely on technical grounds and because of malfeasance on the part of prosecutors, the government, of federal prosecutors. The government appealed that decision, and recently there was, excuse me, there was a ruling favorable to the government. And so that case very well could move towards settlement because the guards probably don't want to stand trial. Or it could go to trial, in which case there's going to be a question of how secret it's going to be. There's one civil case still remaining against Blackwater that we've covered extensively on Democracy Now!, brought by the father of the youngest victim of the Nisar Square shootings, a 9-year-old boy named Ali Kanani. That case has been moving forward quietly and could very well go to state court in North Carolina, where if it hits trial, there would be no cap on damages that could be awarded. So that really is the wild card to watch. It could be the one place where there's any accountability for Blackwater at Nisar Square.
And to sum up this issue of no Muslims in this force that UAE has contracted Eric Prince for, this idea of a private Christian militia in the Middle East.
I mean, you know, I don't need to wax on my opinion about this. We can look at documents submitted in federal court cases from Prince's own former employees who say that he views himself as a Christian crusader whose role in the world is, you know, wiping out Muslims and Islam in general. They said that he set a tone at Blackwater that rewarded the taking of Muslim life, viewed the operations in Iraq as, quote, payback for 9/11, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. So the idea that he would implement a policy that that had at its core that Muslims would not fire on other Muslims if they were working for this kind of a force is consistent with everything we've heard out of Blackwater about Mr. Prince's worldview regarding religion and the supremacy of Christianity over Islam. It's very dangerous, Amy, when you have these kinds of forces in such volatile environments with all of the uprisings happening. I mean, the last thing that region needs is a Christian crusader force that appears to have the legitimacy or backing of the United States government, regardless of if it actually does. You know, it's incendiary, and it's dousing an already burning fire with gasoline, and it's very, very dangerous. The Obama administration, if they're not supporting this, they need to do something about it. If they are, well, then that's serious, and they need to answer questions about what on earth they're doing, continuing this business with Eric Prince's Christian crusader force.
Jeremy Scahill, author of Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army. He is a Nation Fellow, a Puffin Fellow, writes for The Nation at thenation.com, and is a Democracy Now! Correspondent. Samer Miskati, thanks for being with us, Iraq and UAE researcher at Human Rights Watch. This is Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
los amiguitos. En este mundo todo está bajo control. ¿Todo? ¡No! Una aldea poblada por irreductibles galos resiste ahora y siempre al invasor con una poción mágica que los hace invencibles. El cerebro.
No!
Ja volim, ja ne očekujem, ja ne mrzim, ja poštujem, ja se ne bojim, ja
pustim,
ja živim, ja ne umirem, ja sam slobodna, slobodna. Prosopo, ti se lefterija.
Chuck D, Diana Bass. That's right.
Lice to, lice na sloboda ta.
Baby Duke! Yeah!
Open, the limit can't be found. I am a warrior, can't define my sound. What you waiting for? What you think you know? You may never get. Feel the love and hit the target. No more poison, no more booze. Labeled abuse, sick and confused. Institution rules, barefoot and school propaganda used. Rape and fool. Out there there's a jungle and it lives the peace. And it's time to rumble all the shit to release. Strong like a lioness, sexy as a kiss. Out there in the distance, I can hear the diss. Hide your face or you're a whore. No voice, no choice. Souls under attack, mastering the bell. Preaching us about heaven or feeding us the fear of hell.
It's time to go, it's my decision. Time to blow, it's my religion. Live or die.
Poison, paper says in God we trust, giving us peace as weapons, manipulating us, segregating us. The cross is on fire, Africa, Romania, America, China. Put your weapon down and nothing can divide us. Now you can swear there's no love that big. But in darkest hours, souls always yearn to be free.
Gianna Bass, letting y'all know. Piss me, yeah, I thought y'all missed me, I ain't tipsy. See, I support these gypsies, cause I see what they see. Hypocrisy, tyranny, blood from hundreds of centuries. Shed from the dead, at times what the church said. One side is a wall, other side they ain't seen yet. Revolution is a process against the hate. And all this suffering that comes out of the state. So rap, sing, and dance, Tiana Bass. Baby Dukes put them beats all in their face. Horns exposed, this BS going on. We need the media, and all that bias gone. You've been warned, the universe lets it be known. Tiana Bass and Chuck D on a microphone. So a house might be your house that you might own, but the whole wide world is everybody's home. It's time to go, it's my decision. It's time to blow, it's my religion. Live or die, I am the face of freedom. Face of freedom, the face of freedom. It's time to go, it's my decision. It's time to blow, it's my religion. Live or die, I am the face of freedom. Face of freedom, face of freedom.
It's
time to go, it's my decision. Live or die, I am the face of freedom. Face of freedom, the face of freedom. It's time to go, it's my decision.
Down to blow, it's my religion.
Live or die, I am the face of freedom. Face of freedom, face of freedom. You are the face of freedom. The sound of Baby Dukes on the vocals, the one and only Tiana Bass. The face of freedom that sets you all free. That's right. That's right, get free, that's right.
Viva la revolución.
Prosopo, prosopo, se le ferias. La cara de la libertad, libertad. Faccia de la libertad, libertad. Faz de la libertad, libertad.
This is what Manal al-Sharif wants women in Saudi Arabia to do. Get in the car and drive. She helped start an online group campaigning for women to be allowed to get behind the wheel in the kingdom. A mass drive has been planned for June 17. The campaigners say it is perfectly legal for a woman to drive as there is no law against it. They've also highlighted why it's important that women be allowed to drive.
If a husband has a heart attack, what is a wife to do if there's no one else around and she can't drive?
Manal was briefly detained by authorities on Saturday for defying a fatwa or religious edict that keeps women out of the driver's seat. This was after she uploaded a video of herself driving to encourage more women to get on the road. Strict rules that keep men and women apart in Saudi Arabia mean women cannot take public transport. Instead, they have to rely on either male relatives or drivers to get around.
Not everyone is able to afford a driver. It's just too expensive for poorer families.
Manal is not the first to challenge the ban, and if this campaign gets on the road, she'll definitely not be the last. Ali Nardin, Al Jazeera.
Thank you for listening to yet another show of Mindenki Yoga on Civil Radio 98 FM. And you can find us online at lmv.hu// Mindenki Yoga. And you can spell Mindenki Yoga like this. MINDENKIJOGA. And you can also send us an email at mindenkiyoga@mailbox.hu. And you can also find us on Facebook. Just type in Mindenki Yoga, MINDENK space JOGA. We always like to hear your emails and stay in touch with you. And thank you very, very much for listening, and have a nice week.